You know that feeling when you bag some serious information? When you've confirmed a juicy scene with a source? It might go a little something like this.
I mean, there are times where I'm fist pumping on the phone when I've got the guy, like, nailing it for me.
That's Scott Eden, investigative reporter for ESPN The Magazine. And this is the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. Oh, yeah. And now, a word from our first sponsor, who helps make this show possible. The Creative Nonfiction Podcast is sponsored by Goucher College's Master of Fine Arts in Nonfiction. The Goucher MFA is a two-year low-residency program. Online classes let you learn from anywhere, while on-campus residencies allow you to hone your craft with accomplished mentors who have Pulitzer Prizes and best-selling books to their names. The program boasts a nationwide network of students, faculty, and alumni, which has published 140 books and counting. You'll get opportunities to meet literary agents and learn the ins and outs of the publishing journey. Visit goucher.edu/nonfiction to start your journey now. Take your writing to the next level and go from hopeful to published in Goucher's MFA in nonfiction. All right. So this is the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I talk to badass writers, filmmakers, and producers about the art and craft of telling true stories. By the time this hits your ears, I'll be up in Portland at AWP, the Monstrous Writers Conference, hobnobbing, slinging back a few beers, brah, staying at some seedy hotel near the airport where Colson Whitehead, no doubt, is staying in the most posh place in Portland. He's the keynote, and I love Colson's work. No hate. Sorry, I'm a bit toasted off these poor man's mochas I've been making. You know, hot chocolate and coffee. We keep it classy here. Anyway, if you found that intro entertaining, there's myriad ways you can subscribe to the show. Head over to iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher to get this delivered to your feed every Friday. Follow me on Twitter at Brendan O'Mara and at CNFPod, and follow the show on Instagram at CNFPod. There's this thing called the 100 Day Project, started by Lindsay Jean Thompson, starting this April 2nd. It's in the, I believe it's sixth year, and the idea is you do something creative every day for 100 straight days. So I started a new podcast called Casualty of Words. See what I did there? And it's a sub-5-minute show that's a blog and pod form that gives you a creative shot in the arm, part tactical, part motivational. I'd love if you checked it out. Casualty of Words. Okay? Creative Nonfiction Podcast is sponsored by Bay Path University, MFA in Creative Nonfiction. They help make the show possible. Discover your story. Bay Path University, founded in New England in 1897, is the first and only university to offer a no-residency fully accredited MFA, focusing exclusively on creative nonfiction. Attend full-time or part-time from anywhere in the world. In the Bay Path MFA, you'll find small online classes and a dynamic and supportive community. You'll master the techniques of good writing from acclaimed authors and editors, learn about publishing and teaching through professional internships, and complete a master's thesis that will form the foundation for your memoir or collection of essays. Special elective courses include contemporary women's stories, travel and food writing, family histories, spiritual writing, and optional week-long summer residency in Ireland, with guest writers including Andre DeBuse III, Anne Hood, Mia Gallagher, and others. Start dates in late August, January, and May. Find out more at baypath.edu/MFA. So Scott Eden is here. He's an intrepid reporter, and we got to dig deep into his process and deconstructed a bit how he wrote his piece for ESPN The Magazine that just came out in March here on the former NBA referee Tim Donaghy, who gambled on the games he reffed in and essentially fixed games. NBA denies that he fixed games, but Scott's piece reveals that it's what went down. All right, here's Scott.
Where are you from?
from and where'd you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania. So, but the very northwestern corner, what I call, like to call the panhandle of Pennsylvania, that kind of little notch that sticks up. I grew up in Erie, PA, which is, you know, right on Lake Erie. So it's really the Great Lakes region, you know. It has probably more in common with like Cleveland and Buffalo and Milwaukee even than it does the rest of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I think. But yeah, born and raised there.
Yeah, there's a relatively new horse racing track, Presque Isle Downs, which is kind of in that area.
Oh, that's right there. Yeah. Presque Isle itself is, you know, it's like a state park. This little, the peninsula kind of juts out into Lake Erie right there.
Yeah.
That's like the big attraction of Erie, PA.
Nice. And so you grow up there. You know, what were your parents up to?
My father was kind of a self-employed entrepreneur. He had his own computer store, actually, you know, kind of at the birth of the PC era, like back in the late 70s, early 80s. But he did a bunch of things. And then my mother was a school teacher, art teacher, and then became a stay-at-home mom. And it was just me and my sister. And my mother is from Erie, Pennsylvania also. My father is from Western New York.
Okay.
So all of our family is kind of in that area.
Yeah, there's some brutal winters up that way for
sure.
Oh,
yes.
And
lake effect snow.
Yeah.
Just piling up.
Oh, it's brutal. Yeah, when I spent a lot of time in upstate New York, like Saratoga Springs area, and often would drive across 90 through Western New York, and the throughway there is the lake effect snow is no joke for sure.
It is not whiteout conditions.
Yeah. And so when you were growing up, what kind of crew did you run with? Were you with like you know, the athletic crew? Were you with you know more the artistic crowd? You know, who were your people, so to speak?
That's a good question. I guess kind of a mixture. I myself was not a jock or an athlete at all. But, you know, a group that, you know, were the high achievers, I guess, to a degree. But, you know, we had a good time also.
Right. You know, when someone gets into this kind of career, oftentimes it's there's someone or even a book that you can point to that really kind of turned the world from black and white into color, or even someone who recognized something in you and told you to keep going, gave you permission to pursue this kind of vocation. And maybe in high school and even into college, was there a particular mentor that kind of pushed you in the right direction?
Yeah, I guess it didn't really happen until college. I went to Notre Dame. And I think I even got into Notre Dame just because I had kind of mediocre SAT scores. I think I got in just based on the essay portion of the application. But once I got there, the other was, you know, we had to, if you're in the humanities, liberal arts, you had a, you know, the required sort of English comp course. And my professor there, I think, was the first real kind of the first instructor, you know, professor to, or, you know, mentor to kind of recognize maybe a little bit of writing talent. And then from there, you know, I majored in English, and really I wanted to be a fiction writer to begin with. Mm-hmm. So I don't, this is probably a reading habit that may have, you know, been a mistake, but I really got into metafiction and the whole like postmodern, you know, writing that was kind of burgeoning in the 60s, you know. So all of a sudden I started reading like, you know, John Barth's and Thomas Pynchon, you know, these huge sprawling, you know, kind of experimental fiction, you know, Donald Barthelmay, guys like that.
Yeah.
And I really got into that and then started, you know, mistakenly tried to emulate that stuff, you know, and I tried my hand, you know, David Foster Wallace, all these kinds of writers, you know. And so that really was where my mind was at through undergraduate years. I wanted to be a short story writer and a novelist. that was my dream.
Yeah, and with writers of that nature, especially like a Wallace, their voice is like pyrotechnics.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think it's, and I know I've fallen into this of trying to imitate that, and in the writer or artist ego is like, when you write something, you want it to be like noticeably your own stamp. Like, you don't even need to read a, like, see the byline, so to speak, to know it's those guys writing. And you almost want to be tied up in that. You want to be recognizably different and original. But you realize that, you know, trying to imitate that, it's just, you can't fly close to that sun at all. You know, you got to kind of chart your own course.
Exactly. And then, you know, my taste changed radically since then. Like, I can't even get through some of that stuff anymore.
Yeah.
as a reader, you know, so my taste changed over time, and the idea of writing fiction also, of course, was, I dropped at some point, realizing it's just not what I was good at.
I feel like a lot of people I talk to on the show, they've wanted to go into the fiction direction, and then for one reason or another, maybe they thought it was too difficult, or they were just like, well, this actually didn't happen. It's not true, in the verifiably true sense of the word. And there are just any other reasons. Like, why did you eventually pivot from the fiction track to more maybe journalism and true stories?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it wasn't such a clean break. You know, it's not like I renounced fiction. Oh, I like one day woke up and said, you know, I'm not good at this. I might as well try journalism.
Right.
That didn't quite work like that. But my first job out of college was in journalism. I got a job at the Dow Jones News Service. This was, you know, the late 90s. So the internet hadn't yet grown into what it would become. So there actually were like wire news services, you know, like the original the Associated Press back then too. And it was, you know, but it covered the financial markets. You know, it was the same company as the Wall Street Journal. So I was covering the stock market with no, you know, financial background at all.
Right.
I mean, I think I took an economics class once as an undergrad. But it was still journalism, and it was in New York City. And so those were, you know, two great, you know, great. It was a kind of writing.
Right.
But I caught the journalism bug, you know, there as a beat reporter, though. But still, you had time to kind of develop ideas for feature stories and dig around, you know, and learn about this complex topic. And I kind of got really into it. And then simultaneously, that's when I kind of discovered, you know, the John McPhees of the world and the, you know, Tom Wolfe or Gay Talese or Hunter Thompson. You know, I had read that stuff a little bit in college, but really started to delve into literary nonfiction once I got a job as a reporter and caught that bug.
What was the McPhee book you came across that all of a sudden you were like, oh, wow, this guy's doing something pretty special?
And I can't remember what story it was. It might have been Oranges, mm-hmm. actually. This book about, you know, oranges.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was that. And then I loved it so much. It was so strange. It was a strange book, right?
Right.
I mean, how can you create a page turner out of a subject like that? But he did. And so then I just read through them. You know, I think I've read everything.
Yeah.
And it started at the beginning, read through to the end of his oeuvre.
Yeah, he's the guy that did it for me. Like, that's the kind of journalism that really grabs me as a reader and also as a reporter. Like, I'm not a hard news guy or anything like that. It just doesn't appeal to me personally, to my taste as a person and as a reporter. I'm just not that kind of person. But like that kind of journalism that you can follow some kind of quirky character as he builds like bark canoes and in the deep woods of Maine. Like, I'm like, oh, that's something I can hook onto. I really dig that.
Right. Character-based, you know, stuff. And then, you know, he's really an advocate, or I don't know if that's the right word, but he's just really good at structure and really mm-hmm. kind of preaches that. And then, you know, I don't know. He's probably not a great guy for young writers to emulate either, to be honest.
Right.
I mean, he has his own just style that is you know, subtly comic, right? I think he's, you know, pretty hilarious writer.
Yeah.
But he does structure really well. And that's the thing that you can really, I think, is a good thing for writers just starting out to try to really focus on, is how the story is built, how the information unspools. And so, you know, there's this thing called the John McPhee reader, where there's an introduction by one that was written by one of his Princeton colleagues that really gets into his method. That was very instructional. Just that introduction to the John McPhee reader, which delved into how he went about, you know, not just gathering material, but once you're home with all the material, you've got all your notes, then what do you do with them? And so I would go and actually read the books back again and, you know, break down how he went about, you know, unspooling the information in such a way that it's clear to the reader. And then also the story that you're delivering is a story. So you're compelling the reader to turn the page. And there's a kind of, building that structure. So, I mean, that's the essence of the whole enterprise.
Right. And
it's really, when you're just starting out, it's really hard to figure out, you know, where to begin to do such a thing, especially if you're writing something that's, you know, the topic is complex.
Yeah. You need a ton of information to begin with, to even start to noodle with different kinds of structure. And then once you settle on it, of course, then it's like, okay, here's your wireframe. And then you can start putting meat on those bones at that point. But you gotta, you know, figure out like you're doing, you're going like what I like to kind of call like going to the film. You're a quarterback just like watching film. How are we deconstructing this defense here? and then suddenly it's like you watch it enough and you read it enough with everything you've learned, and it's like, oh, you start to see the seams coming apart and be like, oh, that's how he did it. And of course that's how you improve. So how is turning your eye towards structure like that improved the work you're doing?
I mean, yeah, it's vital. And then, you know, you get better at it over time, for sure. When you test things out, I mean, the only way to learn how to write well is to do it. So you just see what works, what doesn't. And then, you know, editors are there once you get in a position where you're publishing and you have an editor to work with. I mean, they help with that too. Yeah, it's just trial and error, mm-hmm. basically, figuring out what works and what doesn't. And then, you know, experimenting a little too to see how far you can reach. But then the structure should come from the material and grow, I think, organically out of the material rather than vice versa. Although McPhee is famous for coming up with the structure first and then the story second. There's a couple of books where he does exactly the opposite of that. But for most of my stories, I haven't done such formal kind of play, despite the metafictional background, which is, of course, all formal play.
Right.
But for me, always the structures grow out of the material itself and the necessities of, like I said, how do you deliver information and in what order so that it's clear and compelling.
And as you came out of that metafictional background and initially being drawn to that and then slowly gravitating towards other writers and so forth,
yeah.
Who were some of the writers that you began to gravitate towards? And then how did you start to form your own voice, something that's comfortable, that comes out of you onto your keyboard?
Yeah, I don't know how that's kind of mysterious to this day, but I guess McPhee, and then I, you know, discovered the old New Yorker. So guys like Joe Mitchell and AJ Liebling. I mean, I'm not the only one who's followed this path for sure, but these are the kind of guys that I considered the masters. And again, very difficult to emulate either any of these guys. I mean, but you know, nonetheless, you try, I guess that's how you start out, is imitation. But that whole old New Yorker, you know, when, you know, probably from World War II on, or even just before, I just fell in love with all of those writers from that era, E.B. White and James Thurber and a guy named St. Clair McKelvey. Some of these guys are just lost to time. And even Liebling himself, all those books were out of print at one point. But it was just, I was kind of entranced with what they were doing and could do. Even John Hersey, you know, he's a fiction writer, but also a phenomenal journalist. I just started reading through that, and that's really also the catching of the journalism bug was a combination of getting that first job and then this kind of reading.
And as when you got that bug there, as you're covering the, you know, the stock exchange in New York, you know, what's the next step for you as you start progressing?
Well, yeah, then I applied to and got a degree of no vocational value at all called the Master's in Fine Arts.
Nice.
In creative writing.
I've got one of those too.
Yeah. So I did that. I decided, yeah, I wanted to do it, but with a non-fictional focus. So I wound up going to Washington University in St. Louis because they waived the tuition. They're kind of known for, you know, you don't have to pay for it. So I knew that it would be at no vocational value. So I nice. Didn't want to take out a lot of student loans
yep.
to do it. So they were offered a generous package. So I went there and spent 2 years in St. Louis.
All right,
working with like a couple of, and I worked with, you know, a couple of actual fiction writers mostly, and was in the workshops with fiction writers. I was like the lone, you know, nonfiction student.
All right, yeah, the token so nonfiction writer.
Which was, but it was good. You know,
yeah,
I don't know. I had to get thrown in with people like that.
Yeah, it kind of teaches you how to. Well, you know, you're bringing your nonfictional taste to that, and then you start peeling off those fictional things that those skills that they have and applying it to your stuff, and it's like, oh, it really makes your nonfiction kind of pop.
Right. I mean, it's all the same. You know, it's still storytelling. I mean. They have raw material too. I mean, coming from life as well as, you know, whatever emerges from your own imagination. But I mean, how much of fiction is based on actual, you know, whether it's, you know, Marlon James and a brief history of seven killings, you know, historical fiction, you know, basing it on actual events. So almost all fiction is autobiographical. So I mean, it turns out that the act of creating the written thing is maybe not so different.
Right. Were you itching to get back into newspapers or magazines after you were done with this program?
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to then try my hand at making the long pieces that I had admired in all these guys. You know, I wrote a pretty long, as like the thesis for the MFA program, a long article. Actually, it was book length. I mean, it was a full-on book about a newspaper that was published in St. Louis in the African-American community called the Evening World. It was a crime newspaper. Hmm. And it had this just kind of amazing history. It was founded in the 1930s by one guy, and he kind of ran it all the way up until he got, you know, just too old to run it, you know, through the into the 90s. And it was like this kind of became famous, you know, in the country because it had this kind of style, and he was covering, you know, the crime that was going. And it was a controversial, newspaper. He's an African American covering. These subjects and crime and scandal in the African American community of St. Louis and all the obvious controversies kind of surrounding that whole project of his. But that article, you know, wound up actually getting published in The Believer a few years later.
Nice.
But then right after St. Louis and the MFA school, I moved to Chicago and started writing for the Chicago Reader, which is the alternative news weekly of Chicago. They've fallen on hard times, those kinds of newspapers, but they were, in their heyday, kind of a great breeding ground also for learning to write these kinds of stories.
So
that was the reason I moved to Chicago, was to, you know, to break in at the Reader, actually.
Oh, nice. Well, that's great. So when you're there at the Reader, what kind of stories are you pursuing that really spark your taste and allow you to take a deep dive on subjects?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, I was, you know, emulating those guys like Joe Mitchell or Liebling, especially their early career stuff when they're looking for, you know, urban characters and just almost like strange people to profile who live in the city. And I was trying to do the same thing in Chicago. So, you know, I wrote about a bar owner who, you know, he was also an artist, and he creates portraits of all the regular customers who are, you know, kind of alcoholics. And there's a kind of, but they're beautiful, like colorful portraits that kind of are like cartoon Latouche Lautrec's. And he's covered the bar walls with his portraits of all the regulars. And it's called the Old Town Ale House, and it's right next to Second City. And it used to be a hangout for all the famous comics that went through Second City. So it's kind of this renowned bar, but it's almost like a McSorley's, I guess, mm-hmm. kind of story. But also about, you know, the kind of ravages of the drinking life. So that that's the kind of story that I was trying to find and did find.
It's great that you can go into a place like that, you know, that it's just an everyday place to find everyday people, and you find these really compelling narratives of these, of these just an every man or every woman that's just like kind of hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, I mean, and this bar proprietor, I mean, he led this amazing life. He was like a, you know, kind of a dropout, but also a leftist radical in Berkeley, you know, in the 60s. You know, he hung out in San Francisco, you know, with all of these kind of late beat generation people. And then but he also was like a scratch golfer and he became a golf hustler like all over the country. And then I remember I played golf with him because I wanted to make sure he wasn't bullshitting me and to see how good he was. And he was a scratch golfer. Awesome. But yeah, so it is amazing once you just walk in the door and start talking to people that you can find guys like that.
Was that something you were always comfortable with doing, the kind of, lack of a better term, the kind of cold calling sometimes you need to do to start pursuing a story? Or is that a muscle you developed over time?
Definitely the latter. I mean, I hated it at first, just terrified of calling people.
Yeah.
But I've gotten over that. But yeah, that is something that was learned, and it had to be, right? Or, you know, but it took years. Like, I just remember just not liking that at all.
Yeah, was it something that you got better at it just through repetition? Because yes. That's kind of the nature of the beast.
I think so. I think so, definitely, yeah. It's like a weird shyness almost, or I don't know what you call it, kind of a lack of self-confidence.
Well, I think it's also... You almost feel like you're prying too much. Like you want to, you almost want to give people some distance and privacy, but at the same time, you kind of need to pry when you have to. So it is a funky balance, and it's pretty uncomfortable. It is. That's no way around. It's just uncomfortable.
Yeah, and then also you're right. Asking the probing questions, the difficult questions, and forcing people and yourself to kind of face up to the. Whatever the problem is that you're trying to put down on the page, because you know you can't have a compelling story unless you're getting at that stuff.
And when you were at the Reader, were you doing the kind of stories that you really wanted to do, or were you trying to, or did you kind of freelance a little on the side to write some things that were more satisfying for you?
I mean, no. I mean, that the Reader was the freelancing,
yeah,
and was doing the stories that I wanted to do for sure. And then they weren't investigative at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, they were more, I don't know, slice of life type pieces. I mean, maybe the closest I got to investigation at that time was a long profile of a kind of like talent scout for college football recruiting. And this guy was like, you know, like his name is Tom Lemming, and he was Chicago based, but had become like the nation's like most sought after, you know, talent scout of high school football players. And he kind of had a controversial position. And that was probably the closest I got to anything investigative at the Reader at that point. So I hadn't learned that muscle either.
You know, what did you find that as you were getting your reporter and writer legs underneath you, like what did you find that you struggled with early on that you slowly became, you know, better at through repetition?
I mean, I guess structure to a degree also. Like once you, when you're starting out and you've got these ambitions to do what your heroes are doing, and so you do go report the heck out of something and gather as much information as you can about a subject. And then you get back and you try to structure the thing. But then it can sprawl, right? It gets really, so I had a problem with sprawl. Like the stories were just, the drafts that I was turning in were just way too long, you know?
Yeah.
So I had to learn how to, and it, you know, maybe my editors are saying to themselves, if they're listening to this, that I still turn in drafts that are too long. So yeah, it's deciding, you know, at what point are you taxing the reader? You know, you really had it's for me, that was a something that I had to learn over time. And maybe I still haven't quite mastered that, but I'm certainly better than I was when I first started out. Mm. I think, yeah, knowing when the reader has had enough, and it's time to move on. I mean, an important element of structure is simply length. Like, how long are you dwelling on something? And then, you know, why? You know, there has to be a reason why you decide to dwell on something. So, I mean, a simple way to also to think about structure is simply length of like certain topics. Like if you're digressing into a topic, why are you digressing there? Why does the reader need to know this now? And how much of that digression does the reader need? You know, you can't be just you're going to throw it in there because you think it's entertaining or interesting. There has to be reasons. And there has to be, you know, if you're all of a sudden 300 words, 500 words in on this digression, there has to be a reason why you're developing that digression for such a long, you know, space. There has to be a thematic need, or, you know, simply the information is needed for the reader to understand X, Y, and Z that's coming down the road in the story. So all those kinds of skills, you know, again, can only be learned through doing. So at first, early on, when I was writing this stuff for the reader, I was kind of figuring that out or as I went, and, you know, leaned on editors to kind of help me through that at first.
And have you gotten to a point where everything you're saying is like, it's a lot to think about and it's a lot to process as a writer, as you're looking to write the piece. So is there a point in your generative phase where you just say, you don't think about it, you just throw it all down, and then it's in the rewrites where you're starting to ask these questions so that you don't get bogged down and sort of plugged up by these thematic things too early in a draft?
Well, I mean, I think some, I forget who said this, that they used like a modified McPhee method for organizing the material. I did the same thing.
Modified McPhee, like, I like it.
Modified, you know, you modify it to how your own brain works. You know, again, based on that on that introduction and that John McPhee reader and a couple other interviews that McPhee had given over the years. So yeah, I use that method to kind of organize the material. But then you break it down into topics, like your material down into topics and scenes, you know, and there's a couple other like journalistic Ars Poetica I've read over the years that have been helpful. Like, you know, what is it's like James Stewart had a book, I think, called Follow the Story. I'm looking at my bookcase right now to get titles. Yeah. And then also this kind of classic William Blundell, The Art of Feature, Art and Craft of Feature Writing. He was an old Wall Street Journal editor. And the Wall Street Journal used to be famous for its, you know, page one feature stories, and still is a little bit, but they used to have like a middle column feature story that was, you know, kind of you know, not necessarily an investigative financial piece or a piece about a company. It was just like a quirky sort of story. And then they were famous for their kind of newspaper style feature writing. And that was helpful, you know, have the organizational tactics that he kind of puts down in this book, which he wrote for, you know, Wall Street Journal writers, essentially. So those kinds of helped me try to figure out how to organize, you know, all this material. And then, then once you sit down to write, you know, I think Calvin Trillin, another great New Yorker writer, says he does a vomit draft where he does just what you say. Just like, get it out. I don't care if it sucks. The sentences are horrible. They might even be sentence fragments half the time. Just get it all down there and then work it out in revision. So, I mean, that's another tactic that I think is pretty useful. Once you've got all the material sitting there and broken down into whatever sections and topics that you want to hit, and you've got your lead idea, say, but the best method then is to vomit draft that thing for me, and just to get it down.
Hey, what is the meaning of this? Well, I want to say that this episode is also brought to you by my monthly newsletter. Oh yeah, that's right. On the first of the month, you can get a tasty bit of goodness sent right to your inbox. My reading recommendations for the month and what you might have missed from the world of the podcast. Visit BrendanOmera.com. Once a month, no spam. Can't beat it. Now back to the show. Yeah, it could be your lead is actually like 1,000 words into your draft. You're like, oh, that's really where this thing should start.
But yeah, for sure. That has happened. Although, I think I do tend to think about the story and its structure a lot before actually writing word one. So my leads tend to stay the leads. Mm-hmm. Because I really do think a lot about it beforehand, before we're starting. But again, you know, the structure of the lead itself might change, you know, in revision. Because every lead has to have its own little mini structure in every section, you know.
Yeah.
So keep narrowing it down.
And when I was talking to Bronwyn Dickey a few episodes ago, she's been on the show a few times. And sometimes we just have her on, we just bullshit. And she was saying, like, she loves hearing – I guess she read an interview or attended a talk of – I think it was Lawrence Wright, who kind of, like, opened up his backpack for the tools he uses when he goes on a reporting trip or something. He's just, like, pulling out all the stuff that he uses to gather information. She loved that. And she's like, I love hearing how reporters – like, what's in their bag as they go out on a trip. So it's something I've actually been experimenting with in asking guests of the show, you know, what they have on them as their things to gather all the information they need. So I might extend that to you, Scott. Like, what do you keep on you all the time so you can gather the information you need to write these big pieces?
I'm curious at what Lawrence Wright has in his backpack. I'm gonna have to go listen to that now. Yeah, and this gets into the whole other aspect, which is the reporting phase, right? Once you journey off into the world to gather the stuff. But I guess I have a notepad, a bunch of them, a tape recorder, you know, a digital tape recorder, pretty basic stuff. There's a certain kind of pen I like, and a certain kind of notebook that I like that I have to use.
What kind of notebook?
It is a Rhodia notepad, and it is a kind of square. What are the dimensions? It has to be like it fits right in your palm of your hand. Kind of why I like it.
Oh, nice.
And it's not as long as a typical, you know, those really long reporter's notebooks.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't like those because they don't rest in your hand quite right.
Yeah.
But yeah, and a certain kind of pen, a ballpoint pen that writes fast and doesn't leak if it gets wet. I'm being really literal here.
No, I love this.
With the reporting stuff.
No, this is great. Yeah, like the actual concrete tools that you use, it's great because then someone else might be like, you know, I never even thought about having a notebook that actually kind of is more square shaped and fits in the palm of my hand. Like, that could be a game changer for someone out there. You never know.
You know, that long one? I mean, when you get to the bottom, you know, then it's you don't have any support for it. So, yeah, come on. Can't use that long one. And I like the graph paper in the Rhodia for some reason.
Okay.
You know, sometimes if you need to sketch something, I don't know.
Yeah.
But then, you know, with the advent of smartphones, I mean, that thing has become a super reporting tool because I take way more pictures than I used to because it's so easy to take photos. So, like, if I'm on a reporting journey somewhere and I know I want to describe physically this place that I'm at, I wind up taking a lot of photos of that place and of the people I'm talking to remember what they're wearing. And stuff, you know, that sort of thing, warning them, hey, this is not for publication. Just, you know, can I snap a picture of you? Or,
yeah.
What else? You know, the digital recorder. I definitely record more now than I used to. I don't know why. I just feel like, I guess the kinds of stories that I'm doing now are more dangerous. And I feel like a recorded version of the interview is more important now than it ever was. And I just think it's better too. I mean, I never mastered a shorthand. Yeah. I have kind of my own personal shorthand that I guess I've developed over the years. But And it's good enough in certain situations to carry me through. And of course, if it's a phone interview and I'm typing, that's really, you know, I can almost get it word for word, but
yeah.
But I feel like it's still important to, in certain interviews, especially if it's like a primary, the primary main character of the interview. It has happened over time that I just talk to way more people than I used to for a story. Like, especially, I think that's just because these are investigative pieces that I've been doing more recently. And in which case, you build the story with a mosaic of just people that you talk to, because there's not going to be any one source that's going to have it all, you know. You'll have, I guess, but you still have a main source. You still have a selection of kind of primary people that are the main informational kinds of, you know, they might be the main characters indeed of the story, or they just might be the fonts, the informational fonts that you're really relying on. You know, there might be a half dozen of those. Mm-hmm. And so I would definitely tape record all of those main characters / primary fonts of information type sources. But then, you know, I talked to so many people that it's just not possible to transcribe all. If I tape recorded every interview, it just wouldn't be possible to transcribe it all physically and actually make deadlines. Mm-hmm. Because I do like to transcribe every interview.
Yeah.
I do not like to farm that out, even though it sucks. No one likes transcribing. It just takes forever.
And it's the worst.
Total drudgery. But I think it's necessary because you notice things that you did. And that's another reason to record. Like, you notice things, you know, in the re-listening to the interview that you didn't the first, you know, that you may not have, that I definitely missed, you know, while the interview was going on. And you know, tones of voice are important, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
It's just not possible, like I said, to do it. So I typically then will, you know, just you take notes for like secondary type, you know, less important interview subjects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say you developed your own shorthand, but do you sometimes find that when you rely on just taking notes that your penmanship is illegible and then you can't remember, like you can't even read what you wrote down? You're like, shit. I know something good is here, but I can't read it, so I can't use it.
Yeah, that has happened, although not that often, but yeah, that has happened. That's yet another reason to try to record as much as you can, you know. But again, like I said, other times where it's not possible to record is if you're like on an all day reporting journey or more, you know, where you're just kind of hanging out with the person. I mean, I guess where you would wind up with, you know, hours upon hours of tape, and then that would just be too much to get through.
Yeah. And so how did you then progress towards the more investigative pieces that you've been doing of late, and, you know, specifically a piece of the Tim Donaghy nature, something you spent, I think, what did you spend, like 2 years on this piece?
Yeah, the idea, the origin of the idea, it was brought to me in like the March of 2017, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was almost 2 years from then to publication. How did I get there? I guess it was starting to write for ESPN, the mm-hmm. magazine. And a little bit before that, though, I had taken a job as a reporter at thestreet.com. Mm-hmm. Which was a online publication that covers financial markets, and business news. But there I started to work on longer investigative pieces, including, about stock fraud. So that might have been, you know, really the first when I kind of got a taste for the more exposing wrongdoing type stories. And then marrying that with narrative. And then at ESPN, lo and behold, stories started to come my way about the dark side of sports. And then, you know, and then there you go. You're all of a sudden doing investigative pieces for a magazine that will publish at length. So that's you know, and the first big one would have been the story about Yasiel Puig. Mm-hmm. The Cuban baseball player who was smuggled out of Cuba, and a story about the whole underground human smuggling pipeline that brought players out of Cuba and into the major leagues. That was probably the first big investigative piece that I did for ESPN.
Yeah, I remember that piece. That was incredible. It's when you're dealing with murky underworlds of this nature, how do you stay buoyant and not get pulled down into that and dragged into the mud?
I don't know if that's ever a danger. You mean like...
I guess just maybe you're in your headspace because you're spending a lot of time with, these sort of seedy underbelly worlds, that it could be easy to just be like, I could see myself getting pulled into like dark places because of it. So I wonder if that's maybe something you experience, or if you do, how you process it.
Yeah. I mean, there can be a fatigue if all of a sudden you find yourself hanging around unsavory worlds and having to constantly think about it and deal with it. There can be a kind of fatigue, I think. And yeah, at the ends of stories, sometimes I just, I don't want to have to deal with that subject for a long time. I feel like I'm thinking at the end of the process of some of these stories. But I don't know, sometimes, the stories are so compelling that you remain interested in getting it right and telling it compellingly. Yeah. So that keeps you going. I mean, and there's a process of discovery too that's always fun, I think. The reporting process is, generally speaking, a good experience. Right. Because I'm out there satisfying my own curiosity about this stuff and trying to piece together what happened or verifying stuff that people have told me. And that puzzle, that game is interesting, right? You hear a story, someone tells you, but then you got to go verify it. And so how do you do that? What kind of people, what kind of documents, what kind of other people might know this same thing that can corroborate? And it becomes a kind of investigative puzzle to solve.
I imagine that feels really good too. Like, say you've got something that's really juicy and then you go to corroborate it, and then you get multiple people saying, oh yes, this happened. It did happen. You're like, oh, yes, yeah. That's gotta be the juice, right?
I mean, there are times where I'm fist pumping on the phone when I've got the guy like nailing it for me, the crucial bit that needs corroboration, like leaping to my feet on the phone in various ridiculous poses. But yeah, no, that's the best.
And when I was talking with Evan Ratliff a couple weeks ago about his book, The Mastermind, which was this Titanic piece of reporting, sure, multi-years, tons of sources, anonymous, some, you name it, it's kind of like, it's a mosaic of stuff. It's very similar to the work you're doing. And we were talking about just attribution agreements and working your way through that, people who want to be, who are resistant to being on the record, but he's trying to get them on the record because it means more to have a name attached to something. So so what's your experience as an investigative reporter, trying to navigate those waters of trying to get the name, but maybe we can say you're an unidentified source, but it means more with your name attached to it. How do you process that?
Sure. So I guess the first, you go in just like, look, this is all, let this be all on background at first, I just want to hear what you've got to say. Right. Like, let's say I'm approaching a source who may know something that's really important or can corroborate something that's really important, but who I suspect might not want their name attached to it, not want to be quoted by name, but at first I'll just say, I just want the information. I just want to know what you know. So let's just keep it all in background. And then
do you just have a notebook out at this point? Like, you're not even bothering recording, or do you record sometimes?
That depends. That depends.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll be recording.
Okay.
Sometimes not. It depends if it's face to face or not, or over the phone. But at first you just want I just want the information. Please, let's just have a discussion here. I let the person know what I'm working on and what I'm trying to find. And then another technique too, though, I found useful, even though this can add to the amount of material that you eventually you'll need to go through, But and it depends too on the kind of source you're talking to. But like, let's say the Donaghy story, which really was a big mosaic of different people mm-hmm. who intersected with the Donaghy scandal in one way or another. Yeah, it could be a referee who was a co-worker of Donaghy's, or it could be a underground gambler who was a bookie in the Caribbean who took bets on Donaghy. You know, I'm coming at these people with a specific question in mind. You know, I want to talk about something really specific with them. But on the other hand, I don't know what they know yet. They may know a bunch of other stuff that's really important to the story. So you don't want to just blaze in there asking them only what the question that you want answered. Mm-hmm. And it's important too that their own story intersects with Donaghy's story, right? So at first, a good way to approach is I found over time that this is useful. It's like, just tell the person to tell me their story, like from start to finish. I want to hear, you know, how your life intersected with this subject that I'm working on, and start wherever you think the beginning is and just narrate your story for me as it pertains to what we're, you know, for instance, Tim Donaghy. Mm-hmm. And then they start at the beginning and they start talking and narrating their way through it. And then all of a sudden you learn up things that you know, all of a sudden this new bit of information blooms up that becomes super important that you didn't know that you didn't even know of it to ask. You know, it's an unknown or whatever the phrase is.
Yeah.
But that does add exponentially to the amount of material. Because if you talk to 100 people and you do that with, you know, 75 of them, like, oh, you've got a lot of material to work through right. at the end of the day. But I still think it's kind of necessary to do that. And then, yes, back to your question about attribution. I mean, again, starting off with just, to me, you know, this is, I guess it's pretty standard investigative reporting procedure. But, yeah, starting off on background, don't worry about it. Just tell me what's going on. Tell me what you know. And then try to, over time, develop a relationship with that person, especially if they turn into someone who's really crucial to the story. You do want to develop a relationship and not just be like, I, you know, totally exploitative and like, I just need your information, you know, kind of a transactional relationship. You do have to build trust with the person. And at that point, yeah, try to convince them to go on the record. Mm. Try to convince everyone to. Often you can't. All right, and there are very good reasons why the person wouldn't want to go on the record. And so it is what it is at that point.
And so then you're getting all this information on the story. You're talking to dozens upon dozens of people. How do you start to corral all this information and organize it so you can then start to conceive of structuring a story at this point?
I mean, yeah, I guess it's transcribing everything, whether it's handwritten notes or the recordings, and then you start, you know, you group it by source or even types of sources. So like, for instance, I had in the Donaghy piece, I had a gigantic sort of Word doc, but that was all my interviews with on and off the record with refs. Mm-hmm. And so that's all referee material, you know, it's kind of there, but then you just transcribe everything. And then this, I guess, gets back to the modified McPhee method. You transcribe everything and then you read through the entire note stock. Mm-hmm. And that includes not just your own interviews, by the way, it's like all the documents you've amassed over time. Cause it, you know, it won't be simply interviews with human sources. There'll be all kinds of other stuff that you've gathered, you know, whether it's a cache of FOIA'd document, you know, like the FBI FOIA file that we obtained on the Donaghy case, or court documents. You know,
yep.
Thousands of court documents on that one. And same with the Yasiel Puig story. There was a huge amount of just going into Pacer, you know, the online platform for accessing federal court documents. So you read through all of that, and then you start in your brain, I guess, starts percolating possible ways to begin. And then the information that is really necessary to the reader, and then that you'll have to, there's, you know, there's expository segments of a story where you have to explain stuff, explanatory passages, and then there's scenes that you want to have because you're building a narrative at the same time. And then, you know, when possible, you want to wed those two things, you know. And, you know, it's also this process of zooming in and zooming out. That's another way to think about structure, like mm-hmm. where you, you zoom in onto a scene where people are actually acting and behaving and doing things. And then you zoom out to explain something. You know, it is, I guess it's the in scene versus expository passages of or sections of a story. You know, whole sections will be just pure explanation. Mm-hmm. And other sections will be the drama, you know, the actual plot that you've got, where people are engaged in actions. And then you set scenes as much as you can, as cinematically as you can, you know, with dialogue, you know.
Yeah.
And description, physical description of people and the place that they're at. You know, certain things like that will pop out while you're reading through the notes, like, holy crap, this is, they're in scene here talking about something that's, you know, it's just obvious that that will be a scene in the story. Because it's like a, you know, a crisis point or a friction point, as they call it, where you know that they're working through a problem that is crucial to the narrative. So that's going to be a scene. But in order to have that scene make sense to the reader, they're going to have to, the reader will need to know this batch of information so that this scene pops and is meaningful. They'll need to know about, you know, this character's, a bit of this character's biography in order for this scene to make sense or to be meaningful mm-hmm. in the way that you want it to be meaningful. So that information needs to come before, you know, that scene. And so all those things become like almost like a math problem that you've got to work out as you, and maybe this is, you know, happening as you're reading through the material. And, you know, I will literally like take notes on a yellow legal pad that are kind of like structure and theme thematic notes that will help then me guide me to when I go back again to the material to kind of, you know, cut and paste from the actual transcripts and put them into like baskets. Here's all the material pertaining to this scene. You know, I got the, you know, there's three people involved. I've interviewed two of them. So here's the bits from the one interview and here's the bits from the other interview. And then you put it in like into a separate file or a basket that you can go back to when you're actually writing the writing the story. So it's like that takes a long time too.
Yeah. Jeez. And so how did this story find its way to your desk?
It was 2017 when the idea came to me by a couple of editors at ESPN because it was the 10th year anniversary. I mean, that's it. It was as simple as that. Mm-hmm. It's the 10th year anniversary of this big scandal. We don't think that the full story has been told, you know, go to see if there's anything there. You start reporting it. And if there is nothing there, there's a moment where you can kill it. Like say, nope, I don't think there's a story here. Or I don't think it's worth my time. So yeah, I think there's like a built-in sort of kill kind of
kind of like a shot clock
trigger.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. Like where you okay, I'm not going to go forward with it. I don't think it's there.
Yeah.
So with something like this, yes. Like I gave myself a few months if I didn't think it was right or people weren't talking to me. I mean, people will always talk. So I'm kind of never worried about that. But you know, maybe just for whatever reason, it's just not compelling enough. After a few months of looking into it, I felt like, no, there's something there. And then you keep going. And then you have also, this is typical investigative procedure for stories like this. You know, you have like a holy grail thing that you think is out there for your getting, like, this is like the big get for this story. And then, but yeah, what if that doesn't pan out? What if that turns out not to be true? Then there's like you gotta have like a plan B for maybe a shorter, smaller piece, you know, that's slightly less compelling. If there's information that points toward the big get, the holy grail, you go after it. But for some reasons that sometimes, you know, it might not be because the thing is, it's not true. The holy grail that you're looking for, it might be just be because, you know, maybe the sources don't want to talk that are necessary to do it. Then you have to have a different kind of story. If you can't get like the, you know, the holy grail, like I said.
Mm-hmm. At what point did you realize you had enough to write the kind of piece that ultimately ended up being published?
That's a good question. I think it's when I started to realize that there are people out there who had heard Donaghy confess to them that he had fixed the games. And then finding more of them, mm-hmm. and eventually finding essentially four people who said that they had experienced this kind of confession. I guess that's when, and I realized, wow, that's like that's kind of the Holy Grail. Absent him confessing it himself publicly, you know, that's really the how you're going to kind of the most compelling evidence that he did fix is going to be that. And that, and the story, by the way, is about, for readers who, or listeners who don't know, this story is about an NBA referee who was accused and was convicted of betting on his own games in 2007, but never admitted to it, has in fact vehemently denied that he actually fixed those games that he bet on. And the NBA and the FBI both couldn't find evidence that he had fixed the games either. So the kind of official storyline from 2007 on has been that this was not an example of match fixing in an American professional sport, even though, you know, there's ample sort of evidence to suggest otherwise.
You must have been the NBA's best friend when they got word that you were digging around into this story again.
Oh yeah. Just like they were, I could almost hear the eye rolls over the phone when I first spoke to people. Yeah, I mean, that is just an episode they want to put behind them, obviously.
Yeah.
Just want to bury that thing, and they tried. They tried to bury it. But, I mean, another reason that gave – another thing that gave that story energy wasn't merely sort of, you know, solving some mysteries that had surrounded the story for forever since it's, you know, since it came to light, but – also that, you know, that there was kind of a news peg, and that is that there was this Supreme Court ruling last year that essentially opens the door for legalized sports betting, you know, in the United States, which there hasn't been since, you know, the early 20th century. Once there's a legalized sports betting, the amount that will be bet on sports will increase exponentially. And, you know, does that incentivize sports fixing, you know? And In the United States, you know, the leagues have long sort of said, hey, we're immune to this kind of match fixing that plagues, say, like soccer in Europe. They've long maintained that they're immune to it. And it kind of, Donaghy was an example of that. Like, hey, here was a betting scandal, but it wasn't even match fixing. You know, it was kind of the official storyline. So this, again, this kind of news peg also gave energy to us as we were pursuing the Donaghy piece.
Yeah, it's an incredible piece, and you know, for anybody who's done any bit of reporting of any kind, you know, you read it and you're like, wow, just the titanic amount of rigor and tenacity it must have taken Scott to go through and gather this information. Like as I was reading the story, I was just equally amazed at just the reporting you were able to do. So like, it just, job well done, man. Like I can't commend you enough on it.
Thank you very much. Really, yeah. Appreciate that.
Of course. Yeah. And I want to be mindful of your time. So I'd love to maybe ask one more thing of you. You know, where can people, you know, find you online to get more familiar with your work if they're not already familiar with it?
Oh, I've got one of those websites. It's ScottEaton.net with a little bio on there and all, you know, and links to all the stories that I've done. Really, since the Reader days, all the biggest stories I've done. So yeah, if you can check out that there. And then there was a book I wrote. I wrote a book once, actually, called Touchdown Jesus, which is about Notre Dame football and Notre Dame football fanatics.
Fantastic! Awesome.
Which is, yeah.
So maybe next time you have a big piece out, you know, gonna have you back on the show. There's a ton of things I always like to dig into with people. We've only kind of scratched the surface. So maybe next time you're willing and able, we can have you back on and dig into some more of this stuff.
Sounds good to me. I hope there's a big one sometime, maybe later this year.
Fantastic.
just started something that might turn into something interesting.
Cool. So. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, I'll take that tease and run with it. So I can't wait to hear more about it when closer to pub date.
Me too. All right.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for the time, Scott, and we'll be in touch.
All right, Brendan.
That was good, right? I think so. Thanks to Scott, and thanks to Goucher College's MFA in Nonfiction and Bay Path University's MFA in Creative Nonfiction for making this show possible. Be sure to head over to BrendanOmara.com for show notes and to subscribe to my monthly newsletter, sign up and get that very next one on the first of the month. Once a month, no spam. Can't beat that. Keep the conversation going on Twitter, at Brendan O'Mara and at CNFPod, on Instagram, at CNFPod, and on Facebook, too. I'd love to hear from you. Let's keep it going, baby. Link up the show on your favorite social platforms and leave a review on iTunes if you've got the time. I deeply appreciate it. You know what? That's going to do it, CNFers. This interview got me thinking. If you can't do, interview. See ya.